Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. This is Managing Healthy Poultry Flocks. I think it's also known as Biosecurity for Pastured Poultry Producers in the program. That's pretty much the topic. This is kind of a more flowery name for the same thing. So yeah, I guess we'll just kind of jump into it. Do we need to make any announcements, or are we good to go?
I think it sounds good, and if you have everything signed, that's just helpful.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for being here. My name's Kevin Ellis. I currently work for Hennepin County in Minnesota. That is the Minneapolis side of the Twin Cities, extends further west. We do have a good amount of farmland. I work as a conservationist there, doing a lot with soil and water conservation projects, wetland restorations, Wascots, grass waterways, manure bunkers, livestock exclusionary fencing, that kind of stuff. Also working on a lot of farmland preservation work in the metro area in Minnesota. Before that, though, I worked with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, also known, they run the ATRA program, which I'll talk about here in a second. I was the resident bird brain, did a lot of poultry-related activities, so I did a lot of educational hands-on workshops, talks like this. Before that, I got my undergrad degree at Texas A&M University. I'm from Texas originally, but have bounced back and forth between Texas and Iowa in poultry science, which is my very specific niche in the livestock world. And then more recently, in 2021, before my job at Hennepin County, I graduated from the graduate program in sustainable agriculture at Iowa State. I did the double degree program in sustainable agriculture and community regional planning, kind of adding that land use planning aspect to sustainable ag, which came in handy in a few instances. Yeah, that's my background. This is an older picture with one of our roosters. I had a lot more hair then, so that's why it looks pretty different. So again, I was with NCAT and ATRA when I made this, so I like to give a shout out. It's where I used to work, and they're still running. They have offices nationwide. I think they've gone to a little bit more of a hybrid option, so I'm not sure if they have anyone in the Midwest currently. I used to be in their Des Moines office till they shut down in 2015. But ATRA is a great resource. If you go to their website, tons of guides, videos, podcasts, a few that I've done in the past, but a lot of really good new stuff. They've got some really great agroforestry information now. I think one of the most overlooked things, though, is they have a 1-800 number that anyone can call in 9 to 5 regular working hours and ask a question about agriculture. And they'll hook you up with a specialist to tell you more about it. They can't answer on the spot. They'll do some research for you and get back to you. So it's a really great resource. It's completely free. Yeah, just kind of keep that in there, even though I don't work for them anymore. But I was with them when I made this. So at this point, I did have clickers to kind of answer and follow along with the presentation. We might just do raise hands. I know it's early. If people don't want to do that, we can just kind of move on. But just kind of want to know a little bit about who we have in the room. Is anyone here a current farmer? Raise your hand. Great. Okay. Anybody working on it? Future farmers? How about just farmer friend, not farming, but works in the food system? Okay. A few people, cool. And then anyone just here for the information regarding farming? Okay, so everybody's kind of got a foot in the door there. And then one of my favorites here, any backyard chicken owners? Okay, cool. All right, nice. I don't have chickens currently. I think I mentioned I've had chickens in some way, shape, or form for 17 years, but not currently, unfortunately, living in the Twin Cities, but I'm working on that, and I think I'll fall into that last category. How many people here have kept poultry before? Okay, so just about a good portion. Nice. What we're going to talk about today, kind of building off of this idea of just happy, healthy flocks, what everybody kind of thinks of when they think about chickens on pasture. So kind of moving around, foraging for food, that kind of thing. And how do we kind of maintain that? So this is a little bit of what we'll go over today. Kind of starting with the idea that prevention of disease is the goal rather than treatment, which I think is kind of a no-brainer. We'll go over biosecurity, so kind of doing what you can with what you have on hand in order to make sure they stay healthy. Providing a healthy environment is a big part of that. We'll kind of go over biosecurity as this idea. And then we'll go over some ways to recognize if there is a problem and then how to get the proper assistance if there is, which can be kind of tricky. Kind of, again, there was kind of quizzes aspect of this, but biosecurity was on the pamphlet, and I'm just kind of curious what people think biosecurity is. How many people think it's A, practices to reduce flock contact with possible disease-causing agents? Okay. And then B, treatments given to birds to treat disease. Anyone think of that? Okay, I think everybody's right. But anybody got an answer or got C for the answer? Okay. It is this kind of like big, scary sounding term. And I will say, just kind of as an aside, I made this way back, the earliest version of this was in, I believe it was 2016 or 2017, way before people were kind of familiar with terms regarding like quarantine and transmission and symptomatic and asymptomatic. So I think it might be a little bit easier for this to kind of be understandable. But yes, biosecurity is practices to reduce flock contact with possible disease-causing agents. Again, kind of this idea of controlling the environment, that those factors that you're able to, and preventing disease rather than trying to catch up with a cycle or trying to treat something. So why is it important? Well, let's go back to spring 2015, which is kind of the reason this presentation exists. I put a grant in for doing some educational workshops on biosecurity, but we had a big spread of avian flu in 2015. And again, another kind of quiz portion, but which of these factors do we think help spread the avian flu in 2015? How many people think it was wild birds? Okay. How about carried on delivery trucks between farms? A couple for that. How about carried by on-farm employees? A couple of that too. And then number four, a lapse in biosecurity procedures. Okay, I think people are catching on. It's a little bit of everything. It's some way, shape, or form, it really was driven by kind of a combination of these factors. It was first introduced by wild birds to a degree, but then kind of breakdowns in the system and people not really adhering to what you would call biosecurity principles kind of allowed it to spread. Over 48 million dead birds due to the 2015 version of the avian flu. It spread initially kind of through the Northwest down, made its way over the Midwest and kind of spread that way further kind of down the middle corridor of the country. And again, it was a little bit of everything. It was a lot of that initial wild bird transmission, but again, poor biosecurity really kind of helped it break containment and continue to move along. More recently, last year, we had another major outbreak that affected all 50 states. These are just some numbers from the USDA and the CDC in terms of how many confirmed cases around the country. And if you'll notice, I think I have a light. All right, it's gone. Minnesota had one of the bigger outbreaks, I think, comparatively to the whole country. And kind of the Midwest follows that trend. Oregon has pretty high. California too, and I think California for the fact that there's a lot of birds out there, but Minnesota had quite a bit. So again, kind of seeing that middle of the country spread. It's a major factor why conventional egg prices are so high right now, but again, it's something that spreads very rapidly and very quickly, and this one was a little bit different, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but kind of going back to understanding how disease spreads is a big factor in understanding how to head it off and how to contain it once it's around. So again, for transmission, especially with a lot of poultry-related diseases, again, this might seem very basic, but you have two sources. You have direct or indirect. So direct is obviously two sick birds staying next to each other, sneezes or, you know, droplets land on that second bird somehow and they inhale them and then you kind of know the rest, they get sick. And then there's this indirect, or well, I guess the second point to that is once there are some diseases a chicken can have, or a chicken, any kind of poultry can have, they recover from it, but they become a carrier of it, essentially. There's kind of a window after they stop showing symptoms that they're able to spread it as well. And then indirect contact is contact with an infected object or a fomite. So this could be bacteria or disease-causing agents on things like shoes or feeders and equipment or walls of a brooder, something like that. So that can also lead to some sickness as well. And I feel weird. Sickness is a very native term. I'm going to say it a lot today, so bear with me. So again, thinking about these, what we know in that direct and indirect, thinking about potential sources of disease. So again, contact with other poultry is kind of the first, and that's poultry and or wild birds. We'll talk about that too. But again, shoes, clothing, equipment, that's all controllable. You can clean it, you can keep specific ones. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Like I said, wild birds, insects, rodents can all, in some way, shape, or form, transmit some diseases. It's not a guarantee, but it's something to think about. And then contaminated feed, air, water, soil. So a lot of these agents can also last in soil for a little bit longer, depending on management and how things are moved around. So again, something to keep in mind. And then vehicles, which is a big one in that they're moving all over the place and they can pick up something. I like to use the example of like, you know, your car is in a parking lot and there's a lot of wild birds. You kind of drive through some of their droppings and somehow bring them to the farm. Sounds a little far-fetched and it's kind of a long shot, but it does happen. So it's something to keep in mind. So again, wild birds are kind of the first factor that everybody thinks about. It was the major source of the 2015 outbreak, and I think a good portion of the 2022 outbreak as well. What was interesting about last year's outbreak is a high percentage of cases found in wild birds were actually in raptors, so owls and eagles and hawks, which I don't think that was something that was really seen in the 2015 version. The 2015 was mostly waterfowl, and that's typically what we've seen. And so when putting this together, that was kind of the first thing is thinking about what kind of bodies of water you have around your farm or nearby, and what kind of birds that attracts over time, especially migratory waterfowl are looking for a place to kind of rest for a bit, or kind of, you see just geese around, sometimes they always come back to specific spots, and there's a reason for that. It's comfortable and they're not likely bothered. So thinking about where that is on your farm, at what times you've seen those, it kind of goes back to this knowing your piece of land and who's around at any given time of the year. And so thinking about this also is what kind of birds are present in your migratory flyway. These are the four that the United States is split up, and it's pretty simple. You got Pacific, Central, Mississippi, and Atlantic. Mississippi is most of the upper Midwest, so you're Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, down to Louisiana. Central's more of kind of the Great Plains states. Pacific's kind of Utah further west. And Atlantic's kind of more of the Georgias and the Carolinas and up to New England, what have you. But I don't have like a comprehensive list of birds to watch out for, but just kind of, you know, think about what comes in at what time of year and factor that into your management is a big part of making sure that direct contact doesn't happen. So again, minimizing as much contact as possible is good. This isn't my favorite house setup, but what they did is they put the kind of netting over top to prevent birds from coming down. They had feeders and waters in the run here, and we're trying to prevent birds from coming down and getting kind of a free meal or a drink. That's kind of a big part of it is as much as possible try and make it to where your feeders and waters are accessible to your poultry only. And that could be the feeders and waters remain only in the house. Again, this isn't hard and fast. I've seen, you know, sparrows make it into poultry houses and stuff. But again, trying to control it as much as you can is the key here. Let's see, here's another one. This is a pasture broiler operation. They have these really nice hoop houses, which I think the best part of it is you can walk in standing up. If you're designing some, keep that in mind, because if not, it's a lot of stooping and bending down, which is a lot. But they have it where wild birds can't get to those feeders or waters and share that drink or that feed and possibly spread disease that way. This is a really good example of it being completely closed off and any kind of activities to clean or water can be done on the inside as well. Another thing to think about and look out for is pests such as like mice, rats, that kind of thing. For organic regulations, you can use vitamin D3 in bait stations, but be careful about bait stations in general, especially if other animals have access to them. Just be mindful of where those are at. I think one of the best things is make sure that your feed is stored tightly. So I like to use metal drums that have a pretty secure lid. If not, plastic trash cans work pretty well too. You can keep a bag of feed in there or do bulk unless you're doing bigger orders. That can get a little tricky. You might want to look into that, you know, some larger grain bin situations. But also building your pens from the brooder on up to kind of exclude any kind of pests. A big thing is using hardware cloth, something a little bit more tight-knit than maybe chicken wire. A lot of varmints can kind of get through the chicken wire pretty easy. So I kind of recommend that. And then scare-offs, you can use different scents. A good thing when I was very young doing FFA chicken raising, my ag teacher told me about cayenne pepper as a potential deterrent for a lot of animals, especially those that walk around with their nose on the ground, kind of picking up trails. If you put cayenne pepper around the pen, and I had this happen with skunks. It worked because the first time I walked in the barn and there was a skunk there, I freaked out. But if you put down cayenne pepper, walking down, sniffing the ground, they get a nose full of cayenne pepper and it keeps them away. It actually works. So kind of anecdotal, but it works and it's very cheap. Yes. So the question was, what does vitamin D3 have to do with the bait station? I have to say it again because I'm recording. So that's approved under organic regulations, and so there's specific baits made with high concentrations of vitamin D3. And for whatever reason, I believe this is the way it works, rats and mice can't process D3 efficiently, and so it kind of kills them off. I don't know the specific pathway in which that works, but there's some kind of function like that. If that makes sense. And so I think it's in block form, kind of like you see a lot of other rodenticides, but it's a kind of a less toxic way to solve that problem. Yes?
Does the vitamin D3 affect other animals?
The question was, does the vitamin D3 affect other animals like cats and dogs, so like domestic animals like pets? You know, I'm actually not sure. I don't believe so, but I can't say that for certain, to be honest. So I would look that up and ask a vet. I would all say I'm not a veterinarian, but so I would ask on that. But I think one of the reasons it's in the organic regulations is that it's less toxic, and so that it really might not. So again, with the spread last year of the bird flu, a big part of it was through predatory birds, so your owls and eagles and other raptors. And so I kind of add this in, preventing predation's a big key to this as well now. And just some ideas to think about and things I've seen. You can use scare-offs. I found that predators kind of adapt to those over time, especially owls. People have kind of hung like, you know, kind of wind chime looking things of CDs that deflect light in different ways that can help throw it off. But I found with some producers that they catch on over time, especially with same with eagles, even with some deterrents, they tend to figure it out and get around with it. So I think changing it up and not keeping anything super consistent is helpful. So maybe rotating every few months what you're doing. Other things in terms of prevention, closing up the coop at night's a big part of it, even kind of in the summer, so finding a way to kind of insulate and take that insulation out is good for keeping your house safe. There are some solar-powered kind of pop holes or entrances here in the bottom. We'll say I've gotten mixed reviews on those, and they're kind of pricey, so, you know, use at your own risk. But I think one of the biggest things that you can do for pasture poultry is construct something that's kind of a shade structure, low to the ground, kind of provides shade, but it also provides protection. So, yes, question.
So, I had an issue with raccoons hunting during the day.
Okay.
Do you have any tips for that? We got rid of a bunch of the raccoons by shooting them, but in case they come back, do you have any idea on how to prevent ground predators during the daytime for free-ranging hens?
Ooh, good question. So the question was raccoons during the day hunting your flock and not sure how to prevent them. Do you have any livestock guardians, like dogs or anything?
No,
okay, gotcha. Yeah, I would say for that, the most effective thing I've seen is livestock guardian dogs. So even, you know, as big as like a Great Pyrenees, they generally are able to kind of ward off those either directly or just kind of scent-wise too. I found like a lot of raccoons steer clear. Not always. I've seen some dust-ups too. But I would say livestock guardian animals, mostly dogs, is probably your best bet. They're another one kind of sniffing to the ground, so you could try the cayenne pepper as kind of a scare off, maybe around the perimeter of your fencing. But I think livestock guardians are probably your best bet there. Let's see. Oh, so poultry, chickens, especially are prey animals and they have those kind of instincts. Another thing considering the raccoon attacks, do you have roosters on hand?
I do not.
You do not? Okay, because that's another one, is roosters are actually decent livestock guardians. I think people overlook that and they think, well, they don't produce eggs if you're doing egg laying operation, and so why would we have them? They're really good at like preventing predation, and I think more importantly, kind of keeping a lookout and what I call kind of managing the flock. So if you see like hens kind of grazing around or foraging for food, usually the rooster is nearby, if not in the middle of it, and will peck a little bit, but is watching quite a bit and like looking up and around. And generally, if there's a predator in the area, sound up the alarm, and I think having kind of a low structure like this helps with those aerial predators. Maybe not so much with the terrestrial ground varmints, but something to think about also with the raccoons. But combining roosters and kind of those protection areas are really nice. So kind of moving on to more of like sourcing your chicks. If you're buying directly from hatcheries, look for those that have been inspected by the National Poultry Improvement Plan. It's a pretty standard operation. Most hatcheries have it. And then just kind of asking around and talking about reputation, especially smaller breeders, and just kind of seeing how they handle things like this and if their birds generally are pretty hardy or not. It is a good way to go. It's pretty easy these days with reviews just about anywhere. Places like this are great for kind of asking around. Talk to the breeder about different breeds' disease resistance. Some are just a little bit more hardy than others. I know some conventional breeds, they kind of take that out of the equation because they're looking for production only. And so they're a little less hardy, a little bit more susceptible to disease. Not always, that's not a hard and fast rule, but just kind of ask around, and if, especially if you're looking to make a major order of chicks, it pays to kind of ask around and see who has, you know, better breeding stock. And so I think biosecurity starts in the brooder day one when you get the chicks home. I prefer starting with day-old chicks rather than bringing in older birds. So you can bring in pullets for laying flocks. I think day-old chicks get a little bit more acclaim to what you have on hand. You can kind of work with them a little bit more too. I think there's many benefits, but I think in terms of disease resistance, it helps for them to be there day one. Again, they adapt to the conditions a little bit more easily, and there's less risk of existing diseases. Sometimes pullets are a little bit more susceptible or they come with something. And so they'll really tell you how they're feeling in the brooder, and that can be a temperature thing. If they're clumped up, they're too cold, they're away from any kind of heat source like the lamp, they're too hot. But also you can kind of tell when they're not feeling well. So again, monitoring behavior in the brooder, and I'll say this again, I think if you have any kind of chickens or any kind of birds, spend at least 15 minutes a day with them, pull up a feed bucket and sit down, and I enjoy it, it's fun. I think it's one of the great parts about having chickens or poultry, but it really helps you to kind of understand what they look like when they're healthy, when there might be a problem, and that, we'll get into that a little bit more later on. And this is something I'm going to drive home a couple times. Never allow your day-old chicks to come in contact with full-grown birds. That is a big transmission. Those birds are probably a little bit more, their immune system's a little bit more robust, and they might be able to transmit something that a chick can't handle. And again, starting before the birds arrive even, you want to make sure the brooder's cleaned out completely. I recommend changing shavings, disinfecting the walls and floors. You don't have to scrub with a toothbrush or anything, but just kind of rinse it down and clean off any like excess manure, stuck shavings or feathers. Clean the feeders and waters. That's a big one that's really easy not to. A lot of feeders and waters are not easy to clean, and I've spent many a freezing morning doing it, but it really does help, especially in the brooder. And then look for, when you're cleaning, it's a good idea to look for any of those kind of rodent entrances, or if there's any signs of birds getting in or something like that, and then just where there's maybe builds up of dust, kind of remove that as well. And then at this point, this is kind of not a disease-causing issue in the way that we think, like, you know, bacterial or viruses or viral diseases, but their skeletons are developing, and they're very susceptible to leg injuries, especially on surfaces that are very slick. So some shavings or embedding are a little bit slick early on, so in the first couple weeks. I like to put down maybe burlap that's been washed in between flocks, or paper towels, so they kind of have that grip early on. And then about 2 weeks, you can take it up, and they should be fine. But it really helps kind of, if you've ever seen splayed legs and chicks, that can be a source of where it comes from. And then just monitor their nutrition. Usually you'll have them on kind of a chick starter diet, usually very high protein. But just make sure that it seems like they're doing well there. Other things to consider is buildups of moisture ammonia in the brooder, usually from manure, kind of overloading the shavings. If you need to add a little bit more and mix it in, that really can help. It'll go a long ways. Make sure your ventilation is working out pretty well. You want to kind of exhaust that air at some point. And then, again, make sure that your temperature is kind of where it needs to be. Again, the chicks will tell you how they're feeling. Just kind of look at their general arrangement. Usually, you'll want to start pretty hot and then kind of take it down a degree a day until, like, normal room temperature. In between flocks, I would give the brooder 2 weeks of downtime. And really, this kind of applies to any, like, new pen. Give it 2 weeks in between flocks, and that'll help kind of let anything that's there die off. And then, cannot drive this home enough, I'm guilty of not doing it, but observe and record. Like, once you're doing that 15 minutes, just kind of write a couple notes. If, like, you have any mortalities, note that, and note if there's any, if you notice any other circumstances that may have led to it, or you're kind of playing detective, maybe if there's any other birds showing signs that you can kind of head off earlier. Sometimes those small observations can go a long way later when you're trying to figure out if there's something wrong. So visitors. If you have exterior fencing, that's great to remove unexpected traffic. And then, you know, you can put up warning signs, just say, you know, active farm or chickens out or something like that. It doesn't have to be super serious, but it can help let people know. And then tours are a great way to share information. I've been on several. I think it's fantastic. But just kind of keep biosecurity in mind when you have people out to the farm, especially if they have their own poultry. And there are ways to do it. It doesn't mean you have to be locked down at all times. But when you're asking people to come out, maybe ask that they wear clean clothes, non-work clothes, maybe boots that weren't in a chicken pen earlier that day. And then again, if you're on farm, move from younger birds. So if you have both birds in the brooder and out on pasture, start with the brooder first and then go out to pasture later. Because again, that transmission can go from older to younger, not as likely to go from younger to older. So again, big part of this is footwear. And so I don't know if anyone's been on a farm tour where they've had to wear these, but yeah, boot covers, booties, they're very effective. They're plastic, typically single use. When I worked on a research farm for a while, we had specific ones for the pen. They got really gross after a while, but you can reuse them as long as they stay with that specific geography or pen. If you're moving around the pasture, I would say, you know, use single use, but if you could have one for the brooder, essentially, if it's just you. Yeah, again, if you're moving from younger to older birds, have a different pair for each of those. Or if you're moving from, if you're moving from older to younger, maybe switch it out, and that'll help. And then I guess for footwear, one of the biggest pieces of advice is have a dedicated pair of rubber boots for that flock. Or for the brooder, and where you can just, you know, remove whatever shoes you're wearing, whether it's your slippers or your boots, and then just put on those kind of rubber boots right before you get in the brooder. And again, keeping that the history of those boots kind of more local, that will really go a long ways. Having people on farm to come pick up products is great. Again, you can go show them. In the biosecurity world, it's probably best to keep them closer to the gate and not with the poultry so much. Again, booties are great for that. You can have a farm stand at the entrance. Think about refrigeration if you're going to have eggs. Or have a specific meeting place where you have customers out. But again, you know, this is more thinking about in very strict biosecurity terms. But I really think having people on farm and looking at what you're doing is a great way to kind of build that relationship. And so I wouldn't say stray away from it, but just keep it in mind as you're working with biosecurity. And then another part of this is foot baths. You can make your own. They sell some that are pretty fancy and have like water dispersal systems, and you can buy their sanitizer and stuff, but you can make them at home pretty easy. You can get like a shallow tub from like Dollar Tree. If you get a piece of AstroTurf or some kind of like plasticky kind of entrance mat, that'll work well. I would say plastic for sure. And then a long-handled brush, you can buy some disinfectant online, read the instructions, use the proper amount, don't overdo it. But essentially you just stand in, and kind of wipe your shoes like you're going in the house, and you take the brush and just get the sides a little bit, and that's all it takes. Some places you can just step in, do that with your boots, and then move on. But I would recommend doing a little bit of the brush on the sides that you might not be getting with those bristles. But really easy to set up, very cheap. And then kind of thinking about traffic control, you want to place them in areas where people will have to walk through them on their way to see the birds. So again, here, right at the gate with a sign, you could use it going into the building where your brooder's at. It's kind of, yeah, just thinking of that kind of pinch point and having people step through it. Vehicles, again, this might be going more on the very extreme side. And this is really only if, I would say, if you have a lot of delivery vehicles coming through that you know are going to other farms. You can power wash and disinfect the tires. That's a lot of work and it requires a lot of infrastructure, but it is something to think about and maybe see. I think the more reasonable way to think about it is the way you structure your farm and where your pastures are at and how close they are to roads. I would say the one thing to absolutely avoid is if you're moving birds, don't move them over a road or like a gravel pasture if you can avoid it, or a gravel vehicle roadway. And that's gonna go a long ways to kind of reduce that transmission with anything that's rolling through on tires. Like I said, if you can, you can disinfect your car and wash every time. It is a lot to do, but it is certainly an option. I would especially recommend it if you know, like you have a feed truck that's doing several deliveries, either make them park away from the birds and unload somewhere else, or maybe consider washing it. And again, I kind of mentioned this earlier, but keep vehicle parking, even your personal vehicles, maybe further away from the birds if possible. And I mean, if you're driving towards a house, like if you need to be closer to a coop that's out in pasture, park where they were, not where they're going. It's just kind of thinking about that traffic control there. What equipment you use is also a key part of biosecurity. A lot of things you buy kind of already have this in mind, but I like this as an example. These are catch coops for broilers that will be taken to be processed. One on the left was a good attempt at kind of a DIY job. Structurally, it's actually pretty great. And then the right are kind of those ones that you can buy from any supplier. Would not recommend the one on the left because it's built with wood, some kind of plywoodish kind of stuff. Wood is going to absorb, it's permeable, so it's going to absorb some bacteria, maybe some disease-causing agents over time. It's harder to clean that out. Whereas the ones on the right, you can power wash, you can hit with a disinfectant, and it shouldn't be a problem. So just kind of keep that in mind, even if you're building your own, what's the permeability of some of the materials being used. Feed, again, can attract wild birds. Here we have that issue. I think there's some feed spillage that day. And so trying to keep spills down to a minimum is not only going to keep wild animals away, but it's also going to make sure more of that feed's going to your birds, and it's a little bit more cost-effective. And a big part of that with birds on pasture, can anyone tell me what the issue is here? Why there's so much feed kind of around? Does anyone know? Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, kicking it out is a big deal. So, like, they'll walk through it and what have you, and that's an issue. But also, when they're leaning down so far, there's more spillage when they're like motion of eating too. And so, what you'll want to do, even if you have feeders that aren't being hung, I would put them up like on some cinder blocks or like. We have kind of those, or I've used in the past those stepping stones, kind of circle concrete, and you can kind of adjust based on how many you stack up. But the rule of thumb here is you want the feed area level with their back. And generally that's gonna have the least amount of wastage. They're not gonna knock as much out, and it's a little bit more ergonomic for them too. Again, storage containers, this is kind of what I was talking about earlier for your feed. These are really good at kind of keeping anything out of it. And then again, record keeping comes into play here. And you want to keep track of how long you've had the feed on hand, when you bought it, what the manufacturer said in terms of storage, those types of things. And just kind of check it regularly for mold and pests. It's kind of harder to do, but you'll really notice when it's bad. So like things like clumping with feed or an issue, anything moving within it, it's probably an issue. So just kind of keep that in mind. and again, feeding, this is more kind of a nutritional talk, but make sure you're feeding the right thing for the right bird, depending on what they're doing. So those that are laying eggs require a different ration than those that are producing meat. and those that are older have a different ration than those that are younger, and just kind of keep that in mind. Usually they have this all figured out, and if you talk with your feed mill or whoever you're buying the feed from, they'll usually have that that ready. If you're mixing your own, there's a lot of guides online in like mixes that you can find, especially with what you have on hand. Again, it's a whole different rabbit hole, but just something to think about. And if you're mixing your own, make sure you're putting a vitamin premix in because it's hitting some of those micronutrients that they need. Water is a big source of potential disease for birds. So when you have it on pasture, consider source. Consider the type of water used. This is something I would not recommend. Kind of a big tub that's open because this turns into kind of pool time sometimes. And so, as you can see, it's not the freshest water there. Birds kind of go in, take a little dip, and then, you know, do other stuff in there, and it gets pretty dirty over time. So don't let it stand like that open for a lot of times. A lot of waters, you can use kind of those gravity-fed ones. I think the best ones in terms of cleanliness are the nipple waters. If you start chicks on it early and get them to understand, so when you bring them to the brooder, just kind of put their beak up against the water and set them down, they pick it up very fast. And if they're used to that over time, usually they have no issues. There's some plans out there for even just a 5-gallon bucket that you drill holes in the bottom, put the nipples in, they work fantastic. Watch out for leaks though, because those will have slow leaks over time and they'll go under the shavings or bedding. And so you have a lot of water on the surface but won't really notice. So if you're using those, make sure you're checking for that. Good way to kind of identify that is if you're cleaning it, clean it regularly. I said weekly, depends kind of on what the watering system is. Some like those nipple waters take a little bit longer to get dirty. Something like this, very dirty very quickly. So just kind of keep that in mind based on the specific water type you're using. And then general environment. I will say, and this is something to keep in mind when you have birds on pasture, but you have 3 natural defenses against a lot of bacteria and disease-causing agents, and that's UV radiation, so the sun can kill out a lot, temperature and time. So that time piece is kind of why I'm saying 2 weeks is really a good time to move things in and out of brooders. Generally, anything within that time frame is going to die off if it doesn't have access to hosts that it needs. And then temperature. So obviously, baking something at a high temperature is going to kill microbes off. And that's something that, especially in the summer, paired with the UV light can really help kind of keep things down. Whereas when it's cold, wet, and rainy, you start to see a little bit more disease. Kind of same thing with us, like colds happen more in the winter, in the fall. Same with chickens. Stocking density, again, kind of thinking about disease-causing agents through manure or feathers, and that one-to-one contact. Obviously, if you have a lot of birds in one house, they're gonna spread disease pretty quickly. Where if they're spread out, it kind of helps a little bit more. You can isolate and get birds out of there a little bit quicker. Brooder, one of like the high-end recommendations is 1 square foot a bird. It's very hard to do in some cases, especially if you have a lot, but that's just kind of high-end. And then with bigger birds, it's variable. Depends on your system, depends on if they're outside, what kind of pasture access they have. Again, that might be more of a housing topic, but just something to think about. And so pasture management. This is where understanding and knowing the topography of your land and what's around, water bodies, what the pasture looks like, what's down, where kind of dry spots at, where does water pool. This really comes into play pretty heavy here. And so if you can see in this picture, got a lot of lush grass kind of out further out from the houses than right at the houses, which these are on kind of skids, and they'd been there, I think, 2 weeks at this point. They're just about to move them. But the birds kind of congregate just outside the houses. Again, it's kind of that safety idea. There's some feeders there that were not in great repair. But the more patchy things get, there's more buildup of manure, what we tend to call hot spots, a lot of scratching ongoing, and greater risk for that transmission. So just kind of avoiding those, moving quickly. I would say that's way too far gone. You'll want your pasture to still be there, preferably, when you leave. So again, this really varies on your system. If you're doing something like this, they probably need to be moving way more quicker, or way more quickly, like a week, maybe a few days. Again, that's just more something you kind of have to feel out. I don't think there's a really good one-size-fits-all for pasture poultry. It really depends on what you have on hand, what you want to do, how it works best for you. And so you know, keep in mind the history of your farm, what it looks like, the natural history, as well as like what else has been out on those pastures, what those pastures look like when designing that system, and where you want it to go to, because there will be some regenerative aspects of pasture poultry as well looking forward, if done correctly. So again, talking about this here, this is another not great watering system, a little bit better because it's kind of like a trench or like a trough. But this area collected a lot of water too. It was kind of in a low spot. And this is very bad because birds need to drink. They're going to go there pretty frequently throughout the day, and they're going to walk through this kind of muddy mess on their way there. So finding, I would say, preferably a different watering system, but also a different place for it is pretty helpful. And especially with something a little bit more stationary, I think in pasture poultry, a key thing to remember is anything stationary is probably not great because there's a lot of traffic going to be coming and going. So you want to be able to move things and react to different conditions a little bit better. And with something like this where you got to haul a giant, or you got to empty and then haul over all the equipment, put it back up on the cinder blocks and bring the hose over, that's a lot of time taken out of your day. And so multi-flock farms, again, talked about this earlier. Don't mix younger and older birds. There are ways to kind of do it with backyard chickens that I think are a little bit more safe, and if you're interested in that, we can talk about it. Keep the rotations away from each other, especially if you have different, if you have flocks of different ages, and this for very big ones, but make sure that they're not coming in contact within that 2-week period of each other, essentially. So if you have birds going over pasture, don't bring them back, or just over it like the next day. Make sure that you're staggering those rotations. Again, if they're outside, that sunlight is really going to help kill some stuff, but you want that time aspect as well. Again, said it several times, move from younger birds to older birds, wear boots and booties, different boots per flock if possible. I mentioned kind of having a pair of boots for the brooder. If you're outside, maybe have one for that specific flock that's only theirs. That'll help as well. So multiple species. This is something I don't have a ton on, and there's only kind of a handful of things, but it is important to talk about. So obviously what I'm talking about here is something like turkeys with chickens, and I would say do not do this. There are some diseases that impact different species of poultry way more than they do others. So some birds like chickens and ducks can be carriers for something that doesn't affect them, they're asymptomatic with, but will wipe out a turkey flock. Biggest example is blackhead, which I believe is the only protozoan carried poultry disease. Fairly benign for chickens, game birds, don't really show any symptoms, but can really wipe out turkeys very quickly. And again, with turkeys, that are something that's usually, I think for a lot of poultry farmers, kind of a once a year seasonal thing. Takes a lot of planning preparation to look forward to that. If this kind of wipes out your birds, that's kind of a tough loss. And I've had that happen to a few farmers I've worked with. Another thing to think about is it can stay in the soil for up to 3 years. So if you're raising poultry, just kind of think about that. That is a very extreme example, I'll say, but it is something to think about when you're thinking about flock management where you've had birds. I would say it's typically going to be way less, and especially if those birds aren't scratching or really aerating into that soil. But just, again, keep in mind that it can be present. So kind of moving on to disposal, and I'll kind of move through this pretty quickly. Let me see how we're doing on time here. Yeah, just because I think there's a little bit more information that might be more helpful. Burial is probably the most common form of disposal. This is at a farm where they had some burial pits on the other side of those piles. Cover with at least 2 feet of soil at a time. You'll really want kind of deep pits. Be aware of potential predators that can come dig it up. Again, you'll want it, you know, in an area where you maybe have livestock guardians around or some sort of scare offs. It's not really the greatest way. Another thing to think about is nearby groundwater sources and where water is going to go kind of over the landscape and how it's going to go through kind of those dead birds. If you have any runoff issues, you can put a berm around the site. That'll help kind of direct that water. But really be aware of your groundwater. Kind of try to know that depth if you can. Burial's kind of tricky, if you ask me. Incineration's a little bit easier with smaller carcasses especially, but it's a little bit harder to implement. You need a little bit more infrastructure in order to do it correctly. There are also air quality regulations. I'm actually not sure what it is for a lot of the states here, but it's something to be aware of. State sets those. They'll have more information online. And again, it can be expensive. There's up to $6,000 for an incinerator itself. It's probably likely more than that now that I think about it. This was the cost I found in 2016, 2017. And then the fuel costs on top of that. So if someone has it, it's a great way, but it's kind of tough to figure out if you're just doing it for, you know, a small flock. Composting is another way to do it. I think this might be the most effective out of all of these. You can mix it in with some composting. I'm not a composting expert, but you want to keep the piles itself away from flocks, obviously, because you don't, like, a lot of chickens like to kind of tear through compost and turn it over. Don't let them do that if there are carcasses in there. But also keep away from main buildings. There can be an odor associated with it. Obviously, if you know where a lot of pests, kind of those raccoons and varmints are coming in, keep it away from those kind of entry points. And just be aware of the potential odors. We'll go too deep into how to do it. There's a lot of guidance out there. But I would say this might be the most effective way, especially if you have a lot of that brown matter already on hand. Manure management, again, talking about a few things here, whether that's buildup of manure on bedding inside of a house, or if you're on pasture and there's a buildup of manure around specific areas where there's high traffic. Oh, yes, do you have a
question? Quick question on disposal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Trash bag into the trash?
Yeah, you can.
Is there an issue with that?
Not that I'm aware of. I would say consult your local ordinances and whatnot. Not that I've known. I will say in the past with like single mortalities, what we've done is taking it to the vet. We've put it in the freezer. And usually they have an incinerator on site or some kind of disposal method that they have established. So I'd say that's an option. Talk with them. Don't just show up with a dead bird and be like, take it, please. It is an option. And in some cases, again, as far as trash, can't say for certain. I've seen it done. And I think with a few, generally, it tends to happen. But consult your local regulations. Manure management. Again, if you know you have something, like for instance, necrotic enteritis, which spreads through manure pretty easily, you're going to want to dispose of that manure and make sure no other birds get access to it, even within that 2 weeks, just completely change it out. And that you can still compost it and whatnot, just make sure that it never comes close to a poultry again. And then if you know you're removing manure that has become infected, make sure you disinfect the tools you use to remove it. And so that includes shovels, rakes, carts, that kind of thing. You can take it out, you can use it in other ways, but just not near birds themselves. Sanitation, again, kind of general idea. And again, this might be a little bit easier to understand these days based on what we've been through with the pandemic. But sanitizing is really a combination of both that physical action of cleaning and removing the organic matter and then disinfecting that area so that it's free of those microorganisms. Kind of both, like you can't really take like a Clorox wipe on like a pile of manure and just wipe it around and it's disinfected. Yes? So yeah, the question was said not to let birds into compost piles that have mortalities in it, but can they still go in with shavings of manure? I'd say generally yes. I don't know what happened there. I would say generally yes, with the caveat that you'll want to have, like, you can dump it, don't let them on immediately. Like, let some of that composting action take place first, and then they can kind of work through it. And I would also say probably don't let them in if it's exclusively shavings and manure. Probably not a great idea for them to go through it that way. But I'd say if it's like a mix of things and you're really using like those shavings or bedding as kind of like your carbon aspect, then it should be fine, I'd say generally. But again, kind of keep that timing in mind would be your key there. That can help? Cool. Sanitation. Again, you want this kind of combo of both cleaning off the organic material, that kind of physical action, and then also some kind of disinfectant that destroys those microorganisms. Again, that disinfectant can even be UV light or time. But I would err on the safe side and use some kind of sanitizer. There are a lot of them out there. Follow the directions. Is kind of general advice. It usually takes a little bit of time, though. And that's really the key, is if you put something down, you can't just remove it immediately after and assume that it worked. It needs a little bit of time to set and kind of that action to kill the microorganisms. These are some organic approved sanitizers that you can use. Won't really go into them too much, but just some ideas to throw out there. Again, if you are approved organic, talk with some folks that know a lot about it, and they can give you kind of specific ideas on how to use any of these. So vaccines, usually when you're buying chicks, you can pay a little bit extra and they'll have some vaccinations administered at the hatchery. Some of these are kind of like a mist they spray on them, and as they preen, they kind of take it on. There's some injections as well. These are a list of different diseases that there are vaccines currently for. If you get a bird that's vaccinated, it's not going to have all of these generally, but this is something that you can. And so if you know you have a history on farm with an issue of one of these, it might be worth looking into vaccination in the future because there may be something on site that's causing that. And again, it's allowed under the NOP. And so kind of going into monitoring, this is that time you want to spend with your birds and kind of understanding how they look healthy, how they might look if they're sick. So again, kind of raising hands things. How many people can tell if a bird's sick or have? Cool. And then no, about half and half, yeah. And I would say, full disclosure, I'm pretty 50-50. I wouldn't say I'm like a full shot, and I think there's reasons for that, in that some are harder to identify than others, some are asymptomatic, but there are some general signs to look for. And that's what... I thought that slide was next. But again, spaying 15 minutes over time with a flock, once you've been spaying that 15 minutes, you'll recognize that something's off. It becomes kind of immediately apparent. Whether it's behavioral or even odor-wise, there will be something off. And usually there are visual signs right before a mortality, maybe not immediately after, but in the days or weeks leading up to it. So this is a slide I thought we were going to. Here are some really telltale signs that something's wrong. This is a turkey. Don't remember what it had at the time. They had a couple of them. They had spray painted the back just to kind of note that there was something wrong and quarantine them. But this is kind of an idea of what like drooping wings or feathers looks like. As you can tell, it's kind of off to the side. Sometimes they'll be ruffled up. So it's kind of, if you've ever seen a bird shake something off and their feathers go up, you'll see that. Generally, when they're like that, they're not moving much. They're kind of either standing in one spot, they're huddled and sitting down. Breathing problems, you will hear wheezing in most cases if there's something wrong. I wouldn't say if their beak is open and they're breathing heavy, that's an issue, because generally that might just be heat stress, or that's kind of how they relieve themselves of being hot, because they can't sweat. But you'll know if there's breathing problems. There's a lot of nasal discharge, kind of wheezing. This is why it's important to kind of monitor how much feed they're eating over time. And if you see a sharp decrease in feed intake, there could be something wrong. In general, swelling, especially for turkeys, kind of around the snood and face. And then for birds that are laying eggs, a sudden drop off in production. There are, you know, general drops over time, whether they go through molt or they're aging. But if they're kind of at peak production and they drop pretty quick, that's a warning sign. So again, quarantine, this is a pretty well understood term now. This is what you wanna do for birds. Generally, you'll wanna remove them, take them to a different area, away from the brooder, different, you know, stall of the barn, garage, something like that. And make sure all their needs are met. They should have clean bedding. They'll usually be in a smaller pen. It might need to be changed out a couple times. Make sure that the temperature is where they need it, they have adequate ventilation, and fresh food and water. But make sure that they have that space themselves and that they're kind of on their own, not able to infect any other birds. Again, This is where it's really important to have designated boots. If you don't do it for any of the others, do it for this one, if you have a quarantine area, or a foot bath. And just kind of keep in mind when you're there what comes in contact with what, and that you're clean up after yourself. And confinement is okay with organic regulations. In 2011, it was allowed specifically for avian influenza concerns. And so under the NOP, it's inclement weather, animal welfare could be jeopardized, or risk to soil and water quality are kind of cited as concerns. And generally, animal welfare includes risk to disease factors. So these are really kind of your common diseases here. Fowlpox, infectious bronchitis, fowl cholera, Marek's disease, coccidiosis, necrotic enteritis, and then I would say probably the most common are your mites and lice issues, which we haven't really covered here, and I realize I didn't have a slide on it, but using something like a dust bath is really helpful for removing and kind of keeping mites and lice away. Sometimes when they show up, they're really hard to get rid of, and usually take like a full coop disinfection or cleaning and disinfection. So just kind of keep that in mind. If you get them, I really just recommend to clean everything out and then provide fresh dirt baths. These are the very severe diseases that the USDA and Ames is really looking for. So again, avian influenza that's tracked. It was real bad last year. I'm really not sure what the outlook looks like for this year. I think there's already been a couple of confirmed cases. I don't know for sure, but I would suspect it's going to be around for a little while. And then exotic Newcastle disease is one that's pretty well under control, but they're really, you know, monitoring for it. So diagnosing a problem, and this is something that I think a lot of people have never really done before, but it's very helpful in that generally every land-grant university has a diagnostic laboratory specifically for poultry. When I was at Texas A&M, I helped out a little bit with ours, and they can do everything from necropsies to kind of open up a mortality and kind of see what's inside and what signs like swelling or buildup of fluid or mucus that might lead to a determination of what's causing issues. So that's your necropsy or mortality. There's also tissue samples that can be taken, swabs, and we'll go over that here in a sec. In a couple of different ways, and then in blood samples that can be taken. So it depends on the lab itself. Some prefer necropsy only. Some will take some of the swabs that have specific information on how to do that. We'll go over that here in a sec. Has anyone here ever submitted a diagnostic lab sample? A couple of people? Okay, great. So it's pretty easy. It's, you know, paperwork. But most labs are through the university system. You want to just fill out your contact information so they can get back to you. As much information as you can provide on the bird itself and the conditions that surrounded that eventual death. In age, species are really helpful. If you know the sex of the bird, provide that. The whole animal is generally preferred, I think in some cases even including a specific tissue, just so they kind of have everything. Necropsy for sure. But avoid shipping if you can. If you're going to be around the lab or it's a pretty quick trip, I'd say drive it out there, especially if you really want to know what the issue is. You can bring a live bird, but this is probably one of the most important points of this whole part of the discussion. If you bring a bird to a diagnostic laboratory, do not expect to get that bird back in any way, shape, or form. It's once it enters the door, it is staying there. And so keep that in mind, because I have heard some stories where they thought it was more of a checkup type situation, and that's not great. So keep that in mind. If it's a backyard flock, maybe find a different thing. I will say, and I think I might have included this, but I just found the other day, seems very helpful. It's often hard to find a veterinarian who deals with poultry specifically. It's a very niche topic. They're not like other livestock and other species of animals. But the Wisconsin Department, it's the Department of Ag, but it is, I think so, yes, yeah. Do you know what that stands for? I don't.
Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
Thank you. Department of Ag, Consumer Trade, and Protection?
Close.
Okay, yeah. They have a listing, long story short, they have a listing of vets that do deal with poultry on their website that I found, which I think is super handy. I don't know if I included it, but I can find the link and send it to anybody if they want it. But something like that is very helpful, so you're not just calling every vet
because I have some friends who are vets and they don't deal with poultry, and they're like, it's a whole different world. So swabs, I think this is something that's overlooked. Usually necropsy is kind of preferred, but swabs are a really good way if you want to keep that bird alive and want to keep it on site. This is a way to maybe track something that's wrong. And so there's a couple ways to do it. You can go mouth or vent, so kind of through the front door or the back door. Really, the mouth is going to be what most people use. The vent is really only for waterfowl in most cases, for some very specific tests, I believe. So really, we're only going to go through the mouth. And so to kind of give you a visual understanding of how this works, if you haven't submitted a swab, I've got a little kind of a handy, I had to steal this from my dog, way to show you how to do it. Just in chicken will be a little bit different, but just kind of an idea. And so, because you can try and reduce stress as much as possible through this process. So essentially, you'll have your bird, and you will hold it, and you can either hold it on your own or have someone hold it. But what you'll want to do is, on the sides of their beak, kind of hold like that so their mouth opens, and take the swab itself and go to the back of the throat, the trachea here, and just do one or two swabs very quickly, remove your hand, but keep pulling the bird, and then you got your swab sample. It's really all it takes. But again, being very careful not to just clamp down the mouth or pull up like this. You just want to just gently do on the sides there, kind of right here, and it'll open that beak up enough where you can just do a quick one or two around, and then you got your swab. And so generally, you'll take your swab, take a baggie, I would say one per baggie, put it in there. I think, go to the next slide. You'll want to get a brain, heart, infusion broth. I will say some labs provide this, both the swab and the broth itself. Sometimes you might have to buy it. It's about 5 swabs or 5 samples per 3 milliliters of that broth. Most labs recommend using a swab that has a plastic handle rather than like a wood or a cotton. But you just close that up. They also ask that you spray it with disinfectant, like the outside of the bag. Again, if they provide it, do the same. Just like a spray disinfectant, some kind of you can even use like a Clorox wipe, just so if there's any environmental factors, they're not caught on the bag when you submit that sample. And then just give it to the lab and they'll be able to run their test. That's generally how that works. It's a pretty easy process, and I think it does a lot of good, especially if you want to keep those birds alive and not really have to sacrifice one to kind of understand. Again, it really depends on the lab, and I can't say for certain what all the ones up here do. I haven't really submitted any samples to any of the upper Midwest ones. Most of the ones I did was in Texas. But generally, they'll take other swabs as well. Another big one is environmental factors. So you can take a sample of dust using a swab. So just kind of like on the side of a brooder or a house or on a water or feeder and just kind of getting some of that sample, same process, put it in the baggie, sanitize it, you send it. Booties or boot covers, you can also submit swabs on those. And then hatchery debris, so like any like leftover eggs or down feathers that are kind of that are a result of your hatching, you can also take swabs of those as well. So blood collection is another way. I would not generally recommend this if you're just trying to send a quick sample, or at least go get help if you're gonna do it. The easiest way is for 2 people. Again, you got your bird, you can either flip it on its back, have someone hold the wing open, so it's like this, and there's gonna be a vein that becomes very apparent, and that's the best point to take blood from. It takes 2 people, it's very hard to do, and it's very stressful for the bird, so I'd say if you can go to a vet, I would say it's worth it, especially, I'm not very good at taking blood samples. It's very tricky with birds, because that vein's kind of finicky. So I would say, go to an expert, go to a veterinarian, they'll show you how to do it, they'll do it in like 10 seconds. Make sure, if you are doing it yourself, don't take a ton. You just need a little bit in a tube that they can centrifuge in. Yes?
When I showed poultry, they did the chloral test, and they just trimmed the toenail until it quicked, and they just did like a drop of blood to do the
chloral
test.
Oh, really? They're on site?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh.
I'm.
Right.
If it, clotted up a certain way, or was good, whatever.
Okay. Personally, I've actually never taken blood that way. And I'm sure if they're doing that, was probably the diagnostic lab there's procedure, and
yeah.
I'm sure it works. I wouldn't be able to give any advice on, how to do it, but that's good to know. So to state for the recording, essentially taking blood for pilorum, what they've done is clip the toenail a little bit further than typically recommended to get that drop. Was there any problems with, excess bleeding or anything?
They would use some of that blood stop powder.
Okay. Okay, good to know. That's the first I've heard that, but I'm sure if it works and that was their method of doing it, that's probably recommended in some cases. I will say with all this with the kind of warnings that I try to stray away from blood again because it can be very stressful on a bird and in birds or on poultry specifically. Beyond poultry, chickens specifically are very susceptible to stress, and so kind of major events like this can really have an impact. And again, not being good at blood collection myself, I've kind of avoided it. I'm going to look into that because I haven't heard of that as a collection technique.
I mean, that was 10, 15 years ago, so protocol might have changed.
Right. Good to know. Thanks. Let's see. I think I got everything from this slide. Moving on. Again, submitting a necropsy or a tissue sample, it should be a recently deceased bird. I wouldn't say if it's a week or two old, do not send it. They're not going to appreciate that. And I would say chill it as soon as possible. When I was growing up, we actually kind of made the mistake that we would freeze them. Don't do that. Put it in a plastic bag and just put it in the fridge. Probably no longer for a couple of days. Make sure people know, or put it in a fridge that people aren't putting their sandwiches next to you too, unless they're okay with that. And then if you have to send it through the mail, mail it in a styrofoam cooler with ice packs or dry ice, something I would recommend, the ice packs, labeling it biological materials. Again, no later than 48 hours would be the preferred method, and then overnighting would be recommended since it's not gonna be usually in refrigeration. But again, avoiding all that, I think the safest method is taking it to the lab. Some necropsies, they can do very quickly. Some testing takes a little bit longer, but necropsies themselves generally are very visual inspections, and the people who are doing it have done probably a lot of them. I know when I worked at a research lab, we did quite a few. So they usually know what they're looking at and what they've seen. And so you can have that conversation and ask questions too, which I think is the most beneficial part of it. And then I did include, I went and just pulled some info for Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota on the veterinary diagnostic labs. Iowa has two, they're both in Ames. You have your USDA National Veterinary Lab, that's for the real heavy diseases. I think they can do anything, but they're usually not wasting their time just kind of on simple stuff. But the one in Ames, just down the street, does all kinds of your general samples. Minnesota has two as well, one in Willmar, and then one at the University in St. Paul. And I'm happy, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, happy to send all these slides and this information as well. So if you'd like, I can send it on. And then Wisconsin has two as well. And again, I would recommend looking at that list. I didn't link it here, but that list of avian veterinarians is really helpful. So kind of moving on, and so putting this all in kind of the bigger picture here, the best way to approach biosecurity plan, because there's a lot of moving parts here and it's kind of hard to figure out, and I think coming up with a plan is really helpful. Sitting down and at least putting some thought in it. You don't have to have a three-ring, three-inch binder with files and stuff. Just having a general idea, and this can really kind of fit in nicely if you have a pasture management plan and kind of knowing your method of moving birds around your farm, what that's going to look like. And again, cannot stress enough, record keeping is key here. And so again, it kind of outline your standard operating procedure, essentially what your cleaning looks like. How much time in between flocks if you have a lot of moving parts. If you only have one flock at a time, it might be a little bit easier, but taking a map of your farm, going online, just printing out even a Google Images and kind of outlining where your pastures are, kind of getting a better idea of how much space you'll need over your rotation, and mapping that out and kind of putting time, putting it to a calendar. Sounds very intense.
if you've gone through like pasture planting, it's really not too intense, but it really helps to put some thought into it. And then identifying who's going to be with the flocks at any given time, what kind of personnel is going to be helping out, contact info for them. And then again that, oh, there it is. I did put it on here. It was on this slide. Again, if you have a veterinarian, their contact information, even if it's a veterinarian for other animals, on the off chance they might be able to help answer a stray question, and you're not there and someone needs to call the vet, having that in this kind of plan helps. And then again, your sampling procedures. If you have any equipment on hand that you've gotten from the lab in order to submit when you need to. I will say, if they do provide your sampling collection baggies and swabs and blood tubes, have those on hand before there's an issue, so there's not that lapse, so you can still kind of catch what you're trying to get at. So having all this in one place is really helpful in kind of understanding how to put this like thought of biosecurity in action, because it is something that can really, you don't think about at the time. When we're here at the conference and I'm up here talking about it, maybe, you know, kind of think about it, but it's easy to forget. And it's easy to forget until something bad happens. And then there's a lot of kind of going back and trying to figure out what happened. So again, the main basis of biosecurity is really planning ahead and trying to head it off. And I think having something in place really helps, and especially it really helps as like a contingency if you're not there and someone's dealing with it and they need to figure out what to do next or what have you. And that's about it. Other resources that I would recommend, the American Pasture Poultry Producers Association, they're fantastic. They have a lot of really great info on just about every topic. I think they still do, I think once a month or once every 2 weeks, they do kind of a live Q&A, which is really helpful. And then APHIS, the Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service, has some biosecurity information. I don't think they actually track avian influenza cases. I think it's CDC at that point. But if you Google avian influenza, it's like one of the first things, and you can really kind of track updates on specific cases by county. What kind of bird it was it poultry or was it wild birds, raptors, that tracking is available. And that's about it. We have, I was gonna say, do we have any questions? We can kind of go through that.
What are the most common symptoms of the avian influenza to look for in chickens?
So the question was, what are the most, oh, I forgot, we have a microphone, but I'll just be this one. So the most common symptoms of avian flu, it's a little tricky because the avian flu can be very sudden, and so there's not a lot of like that ramp up time. But generally, because of that, like quick, just out of the blue mortalities can be an issue. And again, not to say that any like death immediately is going to be avian flu, but like it can be that. But I would say the more common ones are a lot of that depression and like the huddled and the ruffled feathers and not moving. And I think that not moving part of it's probably key. Again, it's one of those things that kind of mixes into a lot of them, so it could be other things. But that, from what I've heard, is like a very sudden change in behavior is worth looking into. And again, the problem with avian flu is very serious, but like it's hard to untangle from some other ones. So I wouldn't go in expecting that you have like avian influenza, but like generally, it's a little bit more severe in that like sudden death and then like that huddled kind of depression will usually precede it. So yeah. Any other questions?
That's so much a question, but a statement about Lena, that she's got her pet bird and the bird is not doing well, so she runs into the vet office and puts the bird on the counter and the vet looks at it and says, "I'm sorry, dear, your bird is dead." And Lena can't believe it, so the doc goes back and he gets this black lab, and black lab rolls the bird over, and he says, "Again, you know, that bird is dead." And she says, "Absolutely no way, that bird, that's, she plays possum when there's a dog around." So finally the vet goes back and he gets a cat and puts the cat up there and turns around and then the bird didn't fly, and Lena says, "Yeah, I guess you're right, because that bird would have taken off if there was a cat around." And so, and she says, "How much do I owe you
bringing the bird in, she said, the doc says, well, it's $50 for the office visit, $300 for the lab test, and $300 for the CAT scan. So there is a, there, every time you turn around at any kind of disease, that's the cost of it. But what you're going about there is prevention. So prevention is a dollar saved for every penny expense in it. So thanks.
Yeah, thank you. That's a huge point. Thank you for that. Which I'm realizing did not mention all, but yeah, the cost of treating is huge. Vet bills are very high, but yeah, that's, I like that joke. I might borrow that if you don't mind. Yes.
With highly pathogenic avian influenza, what I've heard is basically when it shows up, sorry, they're either all dead, they're all gonna die. You have to call them, end of discussion. Has there been any more recent studies or information about preventative care? So if it shows up, your birds might have a chance with the highly pathogenic as they do with the low pathogenic.
Ooh, that's a good question.
You'll be able to sell an answer for millions if you have one.
I don't have those millions, unfortunately. Not that I know. And I know that really the responses in terms of culling an entire flock or the flock dying out is more, well, at least the culling part is more of just better safe than sorry and trying containing the spread. In terms of preventative treatments, I really don't have any. And I haven't heard any reliable ones that have shown good results. I think part of that might be that studies on avian influenza are very hard to do, and I think very like locked down. And so the conditions are very specific, and I think it's hard to translate, especially into like a pastured poultry system. I don't know if there's any avian influenza like lab studies that have used that system. And so, unfortunately, I don't know of any. I'd be willing to keep an eye out, especially with the two major events, both in 2022 and 2015. I think they're going to start looking into that a little bit more. But the response to a lot of the recent outbreaks have been just kind of all hands on deck, we got to contain it, rather than kind of thinking about that treatment, unfortunately. But yeah, I don't have a good answer. It's a good question, though. I'm wondering if it's going to move that direction in terms of the research going forward. But yes.
Have you heard of that infection coming to actual pastured poultry flocks? Or just like industrial, like scary, dense operations?
I have. I think it's one of those things that I, being a very big proponent of pasture poultry, and I think there's a lot of immune responses to be gained by having chickens outside, especially if you're controlling as many factors as you can. And so, unfortunately, the avian flu, like, it really hits everything. And I think the way it does that is in kind of your large conventional spaces. It's hard to control because there's so many birds, such a little space, and a lot of moving parts, so people moving from farm to farm, that really causes it. Whereas the issue in pasture poultry is really kind of that exposure to wild birds and just kind of an off chance, because it doesn't really take much from what I can tell. Thank you. It's kind of one of those things that it kind of affects everybody. I've seen it in everything, again, from like owls to backyard chickens that, you know, they only have two or three really well-spaced and kept very clean operations, and they get it too. So I'd like to think that there's some added immunity for pasture poultry, but I think it's just the routes of transmission are a little bit different, and it really kind of affects everyone, unfortunately. Any other questions? I got about 10 more minutes. I had a clicker aspect of this. I do have a short quiz we can do, like raise hands, but we can also skip it if no one wants to do it. But no one wants to, okay, yeah. I'm happy to take questions on this. Again, I'm working more on water and soil, or soil and water conservation projects these days, but we do, for instance, when avian influenza showed up in Hennepin County, they were like, hey, you know how to talk about this stuff. So I still do this from time to time. I have this weird poultry knowledge, and so I like to share it as much as possible. So please, if you'd like a card, I'm happy to give you one, or contact info. I think, if I skip past the quiz. Oh, is it? Okay, great. That's good to know. I didn't know it was in there. But yeah, here's my office phone and email. So please feel free to reach out. And then again, I would definitely understate reaching out to ATRA and NCAT. They've got great specialists. They do some wonderful work. And again, that's kind of where this came from. Also, I think I have to put a disclaimer, even after this grant ran out, but this was supported by USDA, NIFA, National Institute of Food and Agriculture. I got a grant, and then through the Southern Extension Risk Management Education. I was working in Texas at the time, so that's where a lot of this came from. But I've adapted it for different areas of the country. So I have one for Texas and the Carolinas. So if you have any friends and family in other states, happy to send it to them as well. But thank you all for your time. And like I said, if you have any other questions, feel free to come up and chat one-on-one. And if not, enjoy the conference. I'm happy to be back. It's my first time since 2020, right before everything changed. So, yeah.
I have a question. Yeah.
So the question was, does the biosecurity, can it be overkill sometimes for some of the larger industrial conventional stuff? Yes and no. I think it can sound very, very specific in like procedures you have to do. This is the operating procedure. You have to change in and out of clothes or take a shower as you go into the houses and stuff. Having been in some of those houses and doing research way back in the day, there wasn't a lot of it actually happening. And that's why I kind of included in one of like those factors for why the bird flu spread in 2015, kind of that lapse in biosecurity. Not a lot of it gets followed sometimes, and I think that's kind of why it sounds more intimidating than it is, in that it's kind of just like that plan, and without kind of that implementation of the plan, doesn't really do you any good. And so it can, and I think like even parts of my presentation here sound like very overkill, like disinfecting your car tires as you come in and off the farm. I don't think anyone's gonna realistically do that. I think offering as an option is good, but you know, there's things that sound good in theory and then just don't make sense practically. And I think a lot of like conventional kind of goes like that. There are some extreme cases. I have seen a few where you do have to shower in and out. I think that may be a little bit much. And I think the reason why for them is it's such a great financial investment at that scale that they're trying to hold to that. But yeah, I do agree. Like it can seem a little bit much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, and I think it's a matter of how it's set up, in my opinion. It's trying to make an environment that's completely controllable, and I think there's issues with that. Well, I think, like, completely controllable in that there's nothing coming in from the outside world, but then, like, what happens within it, we can kind of, like, put Band-Aid solutions over it to try and, like, you know, make it through, and I think that's where part of that comes. And so, you know, I think, to your point, like, keeping a better idea of what it looks like inside the house in terms of how that contributes is huge, and I do think it's kind of overlooked sometimes. I that's why I tried to put some of those things in here, like stocking density and stuff like that, because like that is very real. And I think for some conventional, there are some maybe not quick fixes, but like some ways to alleviate that stress, and so they try to control the outside as much as they can, or the outside coming in as much as they can, rather than that. But it's more opinion, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, thanks again for sharing some time with me, and thank you for the joke. That was great. Yeah, exactly. Tried with my toy, so yeah. Thank you all very much.